to order. And just a reminder, since we have a larger group today, is that we don't want any cell phones, or you will not be able to be in the rest of the hearing, so make sure they're turned off. Welcome, and we had a late start on where we ran long on the floor today, so we gave members a few extra moments to grab a bite before we came to committee today. So welcome today. Just for the record, we have two of our members, Senator Atkinson, Senator Bruce Starr, are both in Chicago for a National Conference of State Legislators meeting. So it's not because they're not interested, but they have been excused, and they've been actively involved in these issues. And as we go forward, we'll be with the committee. First thing I want to do is I'd like to acknowledge Mr. Nigel Jaques, who I see is in the back of the room, our own Pulitzer Prize winner. Congratulations again for that. That is a tremendous honor. Today we are going to have our first public hearings on bills dealing with utility acquisition or running a utility, or having, in the case of Senate Bill 671, tools that could be used for some individuals to run a utility. I want to make it clear this will be the first hearing on this, and we'll be bringing these bills back next week for further discussion. I do want to note that I found it very interesting that and then please, as you know, for the last 3 months, we've had various issues dealing with utilities here in the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee, as well as Senate Revenue Committee. And it's an open process, and we like people participating. And I know one of the big issues on the failed effort by TPG to purchase PGE was that there was a lot of differences between what was said and what was said in private and was done behind closed doors. And only found it slightly interesting reading the Oregonian today that the city of Portland has at least followed some of that and likes the secrecy idea. But we're open here, and we're glad that everybody is going to have an opportunity to talk on the record. So with that, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1008 and introduce the proponents of this piece of legislation, the Honorable David Nelson, Honorable Ryan Deckert, and Honorable Vicki Berger. I'll let you guys proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are very happy to, and Senator Simoner Sanderson and Senator Walker, very delighted to be back before you and to return and describe the development of a bill that we had briefed the committee about a month ago. We have now put the flesh on the bones that was asked of us, and we feel we have a defined product before you in the dash 5 amendments which are in front of you now. Senator David Nelson, Representative Vicki Berger, and I introduced this bill because we were frustrated by the lack of appealing options to take over operations of PGE. This utility is incredibly important for the economic development and livability of our region, serving over half of Oregon residents. We conceived Senate Bill 1008 as a vehicle that would allow PGE's customers from the Intels and the Precision Castparts and the large industrials to residents, a vehicle for them to shape their own destiny, rather than having that destiny shaped for them by investors in other states. Investors, understandably, are interested in solid returns. Customers, however, are interested in reliable electricity and competitive rates. As introduced, Senate Bill 1008 was a legislative shell that outlined our basic concept. It was the creation of a public corporation, a model that we are very familiar and have had great success with in this state, that would act as a consumer-owned utility to benefit its ratepayers and community through access to lower interest rates and exemption from federal and state income tax, which by statute would be plowed back into rates in terms of lower rates. We have a 7-person board appointed by the governor that would be charged with running PGE in a professional, business-like manner to deliver reliable electric power at competitive rates. We also have a set of powers tailored to meet the needs and challenges of operating a sophisticated electrical utility with significant distribution, transformation, generation, and, of course, marketing resources. Since the introduction of Senate Bill 1008, a work group authorized by you, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, has met diligently to hammer out specific language that translates our concept into a statutory framework, and you will hear the details of that, which will begin with Senator Nelson in one moment. Others, including customer-owned utilities, PacifiCorps, and local officials, have played an important role in forging the details to make Senate Bill 10008 into a workable alternative to acquire and operate PGE. I want to thank all the members of the work group for participating and lending their expertise in terms of perfecting this bill. They have donated several countless hours to this product and deserve a great deal of thanks, certainly from us. I'm glad to report today that we have made great progress, and the Dash 5 amendments reflect that. There are three central issues we have addressed. First, and this is our guiding principle, is that it should be a benefit to ratepayers and those communities touched by PGE. What you see before you is an appropriate and representative governance model to ensure that the region is reflected in the governance of this utility. And then third is accountability. Senator Nelson will discuss our deliberations on governance. Representative Vicki Berger will talk about accountability. I will begin by briefly describing the benefits we see in our proposal. Following us will be a panel of witnesses representing those customers who will offer their views on the overall promise of Senate Bill 10008 and the three central issues. First, a proven model. Oregon has been successful in creating effective, single-purpose public corporations such as OHSU or the Port of Portland. In the case of Oregon Community Power, we are creating a public corporation to act as a consumer-owned utility to buy and operate PGE. We can shape Oregon Community Power to fit the contours of PGE without adversely or unintentionally contorting existing law governing the other consumer-owned utilities that are here in Oregon. As you know, there are several important financial advantages that are brought to bear under the public corporation statute. As a customer-owned utility, Oregon Community Power will be exempt from federal and state income tax. Language in the bill directs that savings to flow directly to the benefit of ratepayers. Oregon Community Power also will have access to financing at lower interest rates, which can generate a significant ratepayer savings. We had talked about Port Westward, the most recent generating facility in Oregon. A quick calculation on that one new generating facility, and it's the newest one, is that if you take the lower interest rates that Oregon Community Power would have been able to brought to bear on those on that acquisition or on that build, it would have saved $140 million. That's $140 million in savings just in lower interest rates that you're able to plow back into ratepayers' pockets to the benefit of our region. Oregon Community Power isn't required to produce a return on investment in the form of dividend to shareholders. It's managed on behalf of the customers. Returns from wise management of the utility will be reinvested in utility assets to ensure reliable service and rate benefits. And then I think the chief defining characteristic of it is local control. Perhaps the most significant benefit is the one that is hard to quantify, but recent experience has shown us how incalculable the value of it is, and that is local control. As we have said when we introduced Senate Bill 10008, if the customers have to pay for the purchase of PGE, let's ask them to do it once and then own it. This is the proposal that guarantees that. Customer ownership under the Senate Bill 10008 isn't about ideology or political control. It's about looking after the self-interest of our ratepayers, our communities, and our economy. One note that I should make, Mr. Chair, is, and it's a benefit that we are not counting on, and that is access to preference power from the Bonneville Power Administration. We recognize the economic impact on other Oregon consumer-owned utilities of Oregon Community Power or any other new consumer-owned utility exerted its rights to preference power from BPA. We are continuing to work with COU representatives to craft language to put into Senate Bill 10008 or other understandings that balance the interest of all electricity consumers in Oregon, recognizing as we proceed this is also an issue of federal law. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since Senate Bill 10008 is the only option to buy and operate PGE that the utility's customers have been asked to shape so it reflects their interest and generates benefits on their behalf, while continuing to protect the communities in which PGE operates. Now I will turn it over to Senator Nelson to discuss the governance issues.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from Senate District 29 in Northeast Oregon. And I appreciate the comments of the chair of the committee about the openness of this process, and that's how we've approached this bill, is to make sure everybody has input, put everything on the table, and we're flexible in this whole thing. I think we have a very good structure and the Dash 5 amendments, but we're always willing to listen to issues and concerns from other people. I want to reflect on Senator Deckard's comments about this public corporation model. I mean, we do have some successful models that Oregon has done very well, and so we think that this concept under 10.08 is based upon those and can give us another viable option for acquiring and operating PGE to the benefit of the consumers and communities. I live in eastern Oregon. Most of my area is served by consumer-owned utilities, and so I have a pretty good knowledge of good things that they do, and they're usually very well run because the ratepayers are basically the owners. And so that's the thing that we're working on in this bill. I'm going to discuss five of the concepts. I didn't put them into sections because the Dash 5 changed them, and so I just want to talk about the board, how the makeup of the board is, eminent domain issues, local taxes and fees, the PERS issues, and existing contracts issues, and then Representative Berger will talk about some of the other aspects of the bill. Back to number one, the board. We have provided for 7-person governing board appointed by the governor. And we expect that these board members will be drawn from anywhere in the state based upon the qualifications to set and review policies for a sophisticated electric utility. Senate Bill 10.08 sets up a nominating committee to recommend at least 3 candidates for each board position. And the governor will consider these boards, but the governor at all times retains the discretion to appoint board members who are not nominated. The nominating committee consists of representatives from major consumer groups that are most active in rate setting and other utility-related procedures before the Oregon Public Utility Commission. They are, in effect, the existing watchdogs for rates in our current government systems. We have talked to several interest groups. Cities and counties, for one, have a huge stake in this, in the stable operation. Have made a case to be added to the nominating committee, and we're willing to listen to that and add to them depending upon the will of the committee. The governor's staff has also raised an issue about the timing of the appointment process, and we are discussing that with him. We have met with Peter Cogswell in the governor's office and discussed this very thoroughly. And as you know, the governor set up his advisory board on this issue. I think Peter Cogswell, Mike Graney from Energy, representing Greg McPherson from the House, and who's the other?
Corey.
And Corey Streisinger from Business and Consumer. That's where she's at.
Used to be at.
Yeah, okay. That in general is the board. There's going to be people coming up that will be talking about how we came to that discussion and what the work group came about, but just that's kind of an overview of what the board is. Second issue is eminent domain. The exercise in eminent domain is a very powerful one and great concern to other utilities, and what Senate Bill 1008 does is grants the Oregon Community Power the ability and the power of eminent domain to exercise in the conduct of its normal business. It is barred statutorily from using eminent domain to acquire PGE or exclusive service territory of another electric utility, regardless if it is investor-owned or consumer-owned. So that's, keep it within its confines. That's basically the procedure. Now, there's one narrow exception to this, is if in the negotiated purchase with Enron, if we get to that point, both parties agree for any reason that eminent domain proceedings are desirable, then the Oregon Community Power is authorized to undertake condemnation. And as I understand, there are some tax benefits if that should occur. But it would be a very narrow exception and only for a limited time, only during the purchase negotiations. So that's the second part of it. So we've had the board and the eminent domain. Now we're talking about local taxes and fees. And at the present time, in its present form of ownership, the PGE pays millions of dollars in property taxes and franchise fees to counties and cities. And some communities would face huge shortfalls if this flow of funds stops. So what this bill does, it makes it crystal clear in statutes that local communities would be held harmless in the property tax and franchise fees through payment in lieu of fees or assessments. So that's it. We've gone through board, we've gone through eminent domain, local taxes and fees. The fourth issue is the PERS issue. This is very straightforward. It's equally clear that employees of Oregon Community Power will not, I emphasize that, will not be included under the public employee retirement system. So the last and the fifth item I want to talk about, existing contracts. As you probably well know, that there's a lot of existing contracts in power. It's a very complicated situation, and what this bill does, it contains language designed to enable the Oregon Community Power to step in and assume a wide range of existing contracts, interconnect agreements, and other arrangements. We feel that if we don't do this, there would be could potentially lead to significant disruptions. What we're really trying to get to is just so basically things are operated the same way, because we feel the PGE is a very well-run company. We want to take care of their employees as well as our ratepayers, and keep things pretty much as they are, and just continue our business. We would just like to keep it as a homegrown business so that we have the opportunity to enjoy the benefits as Oregonians. And so now I would yield to Representative Berger on accountability.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you very much for welcoming me here, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Let me add my thanks for this chance to continue our conversation about reestablishing local control over what is one of Oregon's most important economic assets. I originally agreed to sign on to this bill because of my concern about the future of a utility that serves half of our citizens and most of our productive businesses and industries. For me, this legislation is as much about jobs as anything else. It could turn out to be one of the most important economic development legislations we can work out in this session. Remember, most of the core of our businesses in Oregon are in PGE Power. The cost of power is critically important to Oregon as a whole. No one is more interested in accountability than I am, and so I'm going to talk about some of these issues today. Rate setting is the most important area of accountability, but an overlooked dimension of accountability is the legislative process that is underway to craft Senate Bill 1008, with the involvement of ratepayers and stakeholders with a direct financial interest in the future of PGE. Let me speak briefly about rate setting. Since Oregon Community Power won't be subject to the Public Utility Commission rate review, customers have devised a rate-setting procedure based on a standard of cost-based rates for each class of customer. That rate will include costs to maintain and operate electric utility distribution and transmission lines, pay property taxes and franchise fees, and debt service. Under provisions of Senate Bill 1008, rate increases must be announced at least 30 days in advance. An administrative law judge will be assigned to conduct a rate-setting hearing, allowing parties to establish a record on which the board must act to establish or modify a rate. An option to appeal is also provided. Rate setting will occur under rules relating to open meetings and public records law. Audits. Senate Bill 1008 provides for an annual independent audit of Oregon Community Power. The legislation requires Oregon Community Power to maintain books and records in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles and with the uniform system of accounts established by the Federal Energy and Regulatory Commission. A word about the public purpose, which this legislature has put a lot of effort into. Great care has been taken to transfer the responsibilities and obligations PGE now has to Oregon Community Power regarding the public purposes provisions of Oregon's competitive electricity market legislation, Senate Bill 1149. Those of you who remember very well. This has proven to be a more time-consuming and delicate undertaking than originally thought, and it underscores the value of a deliberative approach to building legislation. It also is an argument for the public corporation model, which means that we can do for Oregon Community Power what we do for Oregon Community Power won't affect the exemptions from Senate Bill 1149 provisions for Oregon's other customer-owned utilities. Senate Bill 1108 does address accountability and reflects a fundamental accountability in the way it has been drafted, starting with the views of customers and including the valuable perspectives of other stakeholders. The end product will be legislation that customers and communities in Oregon can support, not just tolerate. More important, it will lead to a consumer-owned utility that customers and communities can count on to be on their side. Members of this committee, I make no pretense of expertise in matters of energy, running an energy company. But what I'm very pleased about is that through this process, the legislative process, developing this bill and the model that is under review here, is that the right questions can be asked and answered in an open process where everyone can come to the table and ask the important questions in a public way. I join the senators in thanking you today for your attention to this really important matter for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative and Senators. I do have one question to kick off with, and then we'll go to questions from the committee. And Senator Deckard or Nelson, Representative Berger, I'll let you decide who to answer this. As the idea of public power, and that's really what we're talking about now, we've moved from a discussion 2 years ago of saving a local utility to now the utility essentially is saved, and now we're talking about public versus private power. I mean, I think that's very clear where we have evolved this discussion. And there has been some overt and some less than overt thoughts that, you know, in terms of what we would call, I think, fairly competing measures, most notably the city of Portland, has in one way or another indicated that they're too far along, they have the bases covered, and then a state effort is not only unnecessary but far, far behind their effort. And I think for the public, I'd like to hear your comments in terms of how you see the legitimacy of where you are in this process towards making a deliberate run at this utility with the current owners of Enron.
I'm going to go. Thank you. This is an important question. I think my answer is this. What we're trying to get to here is how best to bring sort of the governance and control of this important Oregon asset, really, to Oregon's, to where Oregon wants it to be, which is within Oregon. I like this process better than a municipal process, just on the face of it, because this represents the entire state of Oregon and the larger piece that is PGE, not the interests only of the municipality. Not that that group has not been very proactive in reaching out. But when you come to the whole governance issue, that is why I prefer this concept. But I think we're on parallel tracks in looking to how best to bring PGE home to Oregon. And I think it's a matter of crafting the best possible situation, not trying to compete in any combative way on this. Does that address?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of, it does with the other issue we'll be talking about today. But I'm curious about the city of Portland's effort. I mean, there seem to be some undercurrents that maybe you should step aside and let them pursue their plan.
Yes, Mr. Chair, David Nelson again. We have been in pretty open and frank discussions with members of the Portland City Council about this issue. We've also been in very open and frank discussions, excuse me, with the governor's office. And, you know, I think that there is a sense, and this isn't coming from the governor himself, but at least from the governor's staff, and I think maybe a general feeling with us is we probably only had to have one public entity making a bid. And we feel with this bill that we have far more advantages than potentially the city of Portland. And we've openly discussed that with the city of Portland. So it's not as though we're in direct conflict with them or direct competition. I think both parties are trying to figure out the best way to get to the end result to keep this utility within the state. And they've been very open about it, and I have to give the city of Portland a lot of credit because they're saying, okay, you know, maybe you guys do have the best situation. Let's put it out on the table. Let's see what it is, and let's talk about it.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing that I would add to Representative Berger and Senator Nelson is the test for us has been, because we felt that as folks look around and survey, both in the economy and on rates, which are interconnected, but that folks might gravitate. It wasn't our first choice, but we feel right now this may be the best choice for Oregon and for the future of PG territory. And a good question for us was, well, what's the old phrase? Where's the beef or show me the money? Well,
both ones.
Both. I got two movies there, one commercial and a movie there.
Mixed metaphors.
Like to show my diversity and dexterity. But this is...
mixed metaphors.
And mixed metaphors. This really is. A month ago, that was a good question. What you have before you is now a defined product. The various aspects from governance to rate setting to Senate Bill 1149 to preference power to the revenue bond, which you're going to hear about, is all now being contemplated and drafted. And so we're at a point that we were not at 3 weeks ago. And we're at a point that now action is appropriate and on a bill. And we couldn't say that 3 weeks ago. And so now we think this discussion is ripe, and we think we have a model here that is that may be the best model going forward.
And Senator, those of us here and those in the audience, we have a rather large document that over the next number of days we'll be going through very, very carefully, and we'll have additional questions as we move this forward. The understanding as I flip through the bill, at least for a cursory look, is that then this board would hire the operator of the organization, which is similar to the proposal that the city has indicated. Correct.
Yes. Correct.
Questions from the committee of our colleagues?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do.
Senator Walker.
Unfortunately, I'm only up to page 17, so, and how many are in the amendment? 42, 43. So I got a long way to go. But a couple questions come to mind from each of you, because you divvied up, and thank you, Mr. Chair, you divvied up the areas of expertise. So my first question, I'll address to Senator Deckert, because you talked about the governance issue. Can you tell me why you're giving the governor three bites at the apple? And I don't care what governor's in the center office. That's not an issue for me. The issue is you appoint this nominating committee. They put forward three names for each position. If the governor doesn't like those, they get a second slate of three names. And if the governor doesn't like those, the governor can choose someone else. I don't understand that philosophy at all, so maybe you could explain how you got there with that one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, emphasis behind it is how do you get the interested parties involved in a meaningful manner? Because who is on that board? And we've talked about, is seven the right number? Are there more? Do you want to do just a straight-up gubernatorial nomination process? But I will tell you that I like the idea of having those interested parties, those groups who have such a stake, and that is your customers, from your residential, you and I, and our Senator Metzger and Senator Mona Sanderson and I, who are customers of this utility, to get them involved in nominating, because they have a stake in who that person is. And so by having ICNU and AOI and CUB nominating and vetting and finding those right people to deliver to the governor's office, to me, is actually it's going to help provide, because they have such a vested interest in who that person would be, to really find the finest people on a compensated board that would actually help govern this utility. And so I think we're open, but I do think that the notion behind it is actually a very healthy one, and we're talking with the cities and counties of giving them a spot on that nominating committee to really get then your four big customer groups at the table nominating folks.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
well, I like that part. I like the inclusive part about the nominating committee and getting all these people who have a vested interest and expertise. The part I don't like, and is probably a deal breaker for me, is that the governor gets to, after all of that discussion and all that public participation, the governor can say, no, I don't like who you sent forward. So that's the part I don't like.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I don't think constitutionally we can tell the governor whom he must select. So this is how we built into the process, and we'll have folks up, an attorney who will address this. But
okay.
This is the process we built in to really give those customers groups the ability to really have a strong push on who's on, because I think that is healthy. My only other request or plea would be look at the overall good in terms of that's being accomplished, and this is just one part of it. But constitutionally, I don't think we can have them say you must pick this person.
And Mr. Chair, you may be right, Senator Deckert, and I'll have that conversation with Legislative Council, because I have this real concern about the executive appointment process, and I have a bill in this session that we're reworking that, and that's of concern to me. So thank you. And Mr. Chair, can I ask my next question? Representative Berker, you talked about accountability, that there would be 30 days notice. That's on page 11, section 13 in the amendment, that there would be 30-day notice of rate increases. Why is it limited to 30 days and not 60? 30 days seems kind of short.
Senator Walker, it may be short.
Okay.
You have
a starting point?
Yeah, you have to start somewhere. There was agreement that this was a reasonable number. There's no magic, I don't believe. I think the important thing is that there is a process, and there is a notification, and then there is an appeal. I don't think there's a magic to 30 days.
Okay.
This is part of this discussion.
Okay, cool. I can live with that, Mr. Chair. And the reason I question 30 days is little things in the way. The reason I question 30 days is that just doesn't seem like enough time to give notice and give people a chance to be prepared. So I thought maybe 60 would be more appropriate, but.
Fair question for discussion.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, another question of Senator Nelson. Senator Nelson, you talked about the Oregon community power would be barred from any use of eminent domain.
No, it's not barred. They would have the right of eminent domain for the conduct of its normal business. And then there's one narrow exception that would occur during the negotiations of purchasing with Enron. Because evidently there potentially could be some tax benefits if there is an eminent domain proceedings. And I don't know the details of that, and I think there'll be somebody up here that could probably explain that more legalistic terms than I could. But it does recognize the concern, I think, of other utilities like PacifiCorp or Idaho Power, who might say, well, are you giving them the right to come out of our territory? And this section specifically bars them from expanding their territory. But they could use the right of eminent domain within their own territory in the course of normal business.
Okay. And then one final question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we got lots of people here, and I'd like to get to them.
Yeah. The last question is, there's a lot of debt with this company also, and I haven't looked through here. How are we going to fund the debt? How are we going to buy all of what we needed to buy and take care of the debt, too?
That's part of the bond process. We're talking about purchasing underlying assets. It would be basically financed through the rate-paying process. The ratepayers would have the responsibility. The state of Oregon, as I understand it, would not have any responsibility for paying the debt.
Okay.
And I think we probably should have some of the experts that we have some folks here that are ready to testify that can give you, I think, a much better detailed explanation than I can on that.
Okay.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Karen Wallace Anderson.
And just a comment, Mr. Chair. The more I get into this, the more I like the concept. But I also want us to remember that public perception is extremely important in how we get this across, because public owned utilities, depending on the spin, the public may like it, the public may not like it. You know, when government comes in and starts meddling with things, tends to turn the public off. And so I hope we can spin this in the most positive way possible, and that's the only comment I need to make.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brad Cleave, Julie Brandis, and Jason Eisendorf, please. Welcome and proceed.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, Senator Walker. I'm Jason Eisendorf with the Citizens Utility Board. With me is Julie Brandis of Associated Oregon Industries and Brad Van Cleave of Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. And we'll be taking turns. First of all, I'd like to thank Senators Deckard and Nelson and Representative Berger for helping guide the work group through to the product that we have before you in Senate Bill 1008. So here we are. The PUC has done what all the parties in the Texas Pacific case and the vast majority of the community asked it to do. It turned down the Texas Pacific application to own PGE. The important thing to recognize about that process, I think, was the intense interest in the case from the customers and the community that PGE serves. And this really shouldn't surprise anybody, because an investor-owned utility is unlike just about any other business. An investor-owned utility provides an essential service. It has a captive customer base and no competitors. The provision of electricity service implicates enormous public policy issues, from the well-being of the economy to important environmental issues and issues that are relevant to low-income citizens. This explains the considerable role of the regulator and the public in the behavior of an investor-owned utility, and it is not an overstatement to say that an investor-owned utility is already part business and part government. When a business comes to buy PGE, it buys the assets and it buys the utility's customers, and it buys that revenue flow. PGE's customers have been waiting for many years for a responsible owner and manager of our utility, who is interested in serving us, not in controlling Western energy markets or walking away with $1 billion or in reselling the utility. We are tired of this game. We have waited this long, and we really should not settle for anything less than what is our own best interests. It is time to take control of our own destiny, as Representative Berger said, and not depend on a process or a game that's being played by people 3,000 miles away or by people whose primary interest is scoring a profit by putting together a deal. I'm going to address two questions. The first is, why should we do anything? Why should we not let stock distribution happen? The second question is addressing the governance aspects of Senate Bill 1008. I thought the panel of the legislators before us actually did a very good job, so I will make that a shorter section and respond to questions if you have any. The first issue is, why not let stock distribution happen? Why should we go through the motions and do something that looks very hard on its face? And in answering that, I'm going to read a couple of pieces of testimony from the Texas Pacific case. I think that helps us understand the answer. Here's a witness in the case, and the question in pre-file testimony is, how long will it take for the plan to become effective? How long will it take before there is a final distribution of the PGE shares? The answer is, there is no certain answer. I am unable to estimate when a final release of the PGE shares to creditors might be made from the disputed claims reserve. The timing is controlled by the settlement, disallowance, allowance, and or withdrawal of the disputed claims. Although the debtors have streamlined procedures to estimate over 6,000 contingent and unliquidated claims, there can be no assurances as to when the claims resolution process will be completed. And this is testimony of Robert Bingham on behalf of Enron Corporation. I won't read you the entirety of Texas Pacific's argument on the issue of why not to do, why not to wait for stock distribution, but a couple of experts excerpts from Calvin Davis's testimony. First, if the plan becomes effective, a distribution would not occur until after 30% of the general unsecured claims have been allowed. It is not possible to reliably estimate how long final distributions would take in the most complex bankruptcy in U.S. history. However, it should be noted that it has not been uncommon for distributions in far less complex cases to take longer than a decade to complete. There would be no assurance that the end result would be a publicly held company. As explained in Mr. Bingham's testimony, either the trustee or the overseers would have the authority to sell the shares in their control at any time. It's fair to say that Citizens Utility Board, in the Texas Pacific case, preferred the devil that we did not know in stock distribution than the devil that we did know in Texas Pacific. But that doesn't mean the devil that we don't know, stock distribution, is a good solution. If we now have the opportunity to take control of our own destiny and have the benefits of public ownership materialize to the benefit of customers, it seems to me that that is clearly a path that we should take. To the second issue I wanted to address, and again I will be quick here because I think the legislature did a good job of the governance aspects of 1008. Let me sort of list as I see it how the governance is going to work. There would be a board of seven. The board would be appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. There would be this nominating committee, and as Senator Nelson indicated, we are in discussions with various other groups who are stepping forward and expressing interest in that. The nominating committee must be a manageable size, but it certainly should not exclude the major interests. The board must be geographically diverse, and yet it attempts to avoid what I would call hardwiring political divisions in it. Each board member is there to make decisions on the best in the best interest of the utility, the customers, and the community as a whole. And in fact, the statutory mandate would be that they would make decisions that are in the best interest of the customer and the community. We have attempted to outline as best as we can, and this is what has taken us some time, to identify the powers and authorities of this board and where Public Utility Commission regulation picks up and leaves off. So we've tried to integrate that as well as we as well as we can. I think I'm going to stop here and turn this over to Brad, who's going to discuss some other issues.
Thank you very much. And before we begin, Mr. Van Cleve, we do have your written testimony. And I'm always concerned about the clock. I don't want to leave out the opportunity. So please hit the highlights of those, because some of these things I see in the written testimony we've had some comments on. Certainly the history of PGE we're well aware of. So with that as an introduction, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I'm Brad Van Cleve, appearing on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. And as you'll see from my testimony, the members of ICNU include large PGE customers such as Blue Heron Paper, Boise Cascade, Intel, Norpac Foods, Oregon Steel, and Westland Paper. I don't want to rehash the history of PGE, but I would like to address some of the concerns that PGE's industrial customers have. Northwest industry competes in a global marketplace, and affordable power is a key component to allowing those businesses to succeed and allowing the Oregon economy to thrive. And as you've heard, PGE is the largest utility in the state. It actually, about 50% of PGE's energy goes to large commercial and industrial customers. Unfortunately, over the past few years, PGE has not been a low-cost provider of power. In 2001, PGE's rates for large commercial and industrial customers increased by 53%. And today, PGE's rates for large users remain among the highest in the Northwest. In addition, they appear to be on the upswing. Just last week, on April 1st, PGE filed a new case at the PUC seeking to raise rates for large commercial and industrial customers by an additional 4.3%. And these rate increases have a dramatic effect on the ability of PGE's customers to compete. And it's this need for affordable power that drives the industrial customers' interest in the ownership of PGE. We think that Senate Bill 1008 creates an opportunity for PGE to lower its costs. Now, while we can't guarantee that that will translate into lower rates, it certainly could. And as you've heard, it's the ability to finance with tax-exempt debt, an exemption from income tax, and also there'll be no requirement to pay a rate of return to shareholders. In looking at the various proposed ownership structures for PGE, there's several key elements that we're looking for. One, a model for stable, long-term ownership of the utility. Two, an opportunity to lower costs and reduce rates. Three, incorporating the policies of Senate Bill 1149 regarding direct access and public purposes. Four, a fair and non-discriminatory process for setting rates in the future. And five, an independent but accountable governance structure. We were asked to participate in the 1008 work group, and what we focused on was three main areas, incorporating Senate Bill 1149, ensuring that the transition from the current PGE to the new utility would be simple from a customer perspective, and ensuring that there would be a fair and non-discriminatory rate process for the future. And I'll just quickly go through how the bill addresses each of these issues. First, on direct access, Oregon Community Power is required to offer direct access to all non-residential customers, which is the same as Senate Bill 1149. We're not trying to change anything about Senate Bill 1149. Next, the board of Oregon Community Power will determine what portfolio options to offer. Next, on public purposes, what we decided was that Oregon Community Power would collect the 3% public purpose charge and that it would provide it to the Oregon Energy Trust or whatever entity that the OPUC designated. But the PUC would remain control over the public purpose program. And just to kind of summarize what the ongoing role of the OPUC would be, first, they will continue to regulate the energy service suppliers that sell to direct access customers. And they would be responsible for resolving any disputes between energy service suppliers and Oregon Community Power. They would continue to enforce the consumer protection rules that are related to Senate Bill 1149. And as I mentioned, they would continue to administer public purposes. With respect to ensuring a smooth transition period, the bill requires that Oregon Community Power adopt all of the existing rate schedules of PGE, all of the existing tariffs, rules, billing systems, and that they keep their books and records in the same manner that they're currently kept so that they comply with generally accepted accounting principles and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's uniform systems of accounts. And finally, with respect to the rate-making process, rates would be set pursuant to a rate hearing that would be governed by the State Administrative Procedures Act. And we envision this to be a process similar to the OPUC where rates are set presently. The PUC would not regulate rates. And the decision on rates could be appealed as a contested case under the Administrative Procedures Act. In conclusion, I think that this bill creates a viable ownership option for PGE. It's the only option that has had the opportunity for significant customer input, and we believe that the legislature should continue to consider it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Brandes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandes with Associated Oregon Industries. As you've heard from Mr. Van Cleve, ICNU does a great job of representing the state's largest manufacturers. Many of these manufacturers are also our members. However, we try to do a more involved job of representing commercial customers. Commercial customers tend to be restaurants, hospitals, and small manufacturers that are very important to Oregon's economy. In PGE's territory, there are 92,000 commercial customers paying over $500 million in revenue to PGE and accounting for 12% of their customers and 39% of the utility's revenues. AOI believes who owns PGE is a matter important to the whole state because it directly relates to the health of our economy. Associated Oregon Industries has a position to actively participate in the development of key proposals impacting the future ownership of PGE. As an example, I sit on and chair a position on the Regional Advisory Board of the City of Portland's concerning the City of Portland's acquisition of PGE. I share that position with an AOI board member, Andy Anderson from Cascade Corporation. PGE sits on the AOI board, and I speak to them frequently about the stock distribution, how that will work, the timing, and the details. And I'm also sitting on the work group drafting Senate Bill 1008. Neither the AOI Energy Committee nor the AOI board has taken a position on any of these, but we want to actively participate, and we think the legislature should as well. It's important to note about why we care. I think you've heard good history about what happened under Enron's ownership. I think it's also important to understand that PGE today is operating relatively independently of Enron. And I think from most of the customers' perspectives, we feel that they're doing a very good job right now. They are not in distress. They are not in bankruptcy. And that gives us the opportunity as a state as a whole to look at all the ownership options. I had time to talk to you specifically about a member who was harmed under the Enron ownership by the 50% increase, but in light of time, I'll skip that today. I think it's important to note what's important to AOI. Very many of the same things that you've heard today and that the senators and the representatives spoke about. We want to make sure that any future ownership of PGE continues, the future owners continue the implementation of the Energy Restructuring Act. We are seeking stable ownership. We are seeking a fair rate setting process. And if I might just digress for a second and speak to Senator Walker's question about the 30-day notice. That is short notice on a rate increase. And I'm going to really paraphrase this and simplify this, but in today's rate process, and we learned this last session as well, that rate setting takes about a year at the PUC, and it's a complicated, adjudicated legal case. Once the final rates are determined, there is currently a 30-day notice given to customers, and that is part of the problem about what happened with that 50% rate increase. Mm-hmm. When the commission, even in the final days, I think it was in July or so, of that rate increase, there was a transcript from a conversation with Commissioner Smith at the time, and asking, you know, are these rates really going to be as high as what ICNU is saying at 50%? And the response is, we still don't know because there's still information coming in and setting those rates. And so that is a very short time frame, especially in that case, for customers to implement. To be prepared and implement that drastic of a change. So there's a historical time on that that we learned about last session when we were advocating for other legislation. We want to make sure that a governance process is set up as independent and responsive to the customer base. And we are always going to be seeking opportunities as a commercial customer group and industrial customer group to seek low-cost power and reliable power. And we understand that there's no promise under future ownership, no matter who it is, that rates will decrease or that rates will go up. But I think Mr. Van Cleve did a very good job of stating that there are reasons that rates could be lower under certain types of public ownership. The work group obviously has not finished its work. This is our first opportunity to share with you today where we've accomplished. We still have some work to do on issues related to the drafting amendments due to that relate to the BPA. and preference power. We have a few little cleanup things that we just caught even after the adjournment of our meeting earlier this afternoon. There are some bonding issues that obviously have to be worked out. And we also need to talk to your colleagues in the legislature. I think you're right, Senator Mona Sanderson, that, you know, how this spins is obviously really important. And again, as I have said, you know, AOI is looking at everything, and my members are sensitive too to the thought of, you know, this becoming a public entity. So those are things that we all are looking at and considering as we move forward with this process.
Thank you. Questions for any of these panelists before we move on? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Doug Goh and Anthony Fisher are going to kind of give us a financial perspective here on this proposal.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, could I just mention a comment?
Yes.
About the governance? I went back and talked to Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council, who's in the back of the room, and I asked him about my concern about the governor having three bites at the apple. And Senator Deckert was correct. There's a constitutional issue. We cannot tell the governor who he can appoint. We can only recommend. So the solution to that problem, if that problem is really a problem for anybody else, is that we have board elections, that those people are elected instead of appointed.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Doug Goh. I'm with the partner in charge of the Pacific Northwest office of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe in Portland, Oregon. And Orrick, Harrington, as you may know, is the nation's leading bond counsel firm here in Oregon. We had the pleasure to work with several of the state agencies, and you've heard mention of we have some wonderful public corporations in the state, including the Port of Portland and Oregon Health and Science University, and I've had the pleasure of working with both those public corporations. Put this on the financial side, put this in context, go back 10 years from today, and this body, the Senate, was deliberating about Senate Bill 2. That was, as you will recall, Senate Bill 2 was the bill that created the public corporation that is now Oregon Health and Science University. And as a reminder, in terms of the bill and the thinking there was, OHSU needed the ability to compete in a very competitive healthcare market, but also compete for federal research dollars, and needed the flexibility to both borrow and for its own capital needs, and instead of relying on the state's general fund and the state's bonding authority. In addition, it needed the ability to enter into flexible arrangements with private business. That included entering into partnership arrangements and even to own stock, take stock in companies, and that is something that OHSU does today. I had the pleasure of drafting the revenue bond aspects of Senate Bill 2, and I think that they have a lot of application to the legislation in front of this committee. I think basically this is a tried and true method of issuing revenue bonds. These bonds, from our perspective, our recommendation, these should not be bonds of the state of Oregon. They do not need to be bonds of the state of Oregon. OHSU has proved with almost $750 million worth of revenue bonds, that most of which have been AAA insured, that public corporations can access. Mr. Fisher will add Wall Street's perspective in terms of the ability to do this. From bond counsel's perspective, you want to have as broad a revenue bond authority. I think the bill, I was here for your initial hearing a month ago. I commend the work group for all the work that's gone into the bill during that period. I think there's still some technical cleanup to be done, but the basic framework is there. And if you give this independent public corporation the broad revenue bond powers that it needs, and that I think that you have basically incorporated in the bill today, and you give it the broad operating flexible powers, not unlike you have given to OHSU, I think it can be a very successful entity. Some of the issues that you also want to incorporate, obviously there's been talk about the tax benefits. You want to build into the structure of the public corporation ability for it to be exempt from taxation, from income taxation, and also on a long-term basis, the ability to issue tax-exempt bonds and get the lowest interest rates possible. And Mr. Fisher will address that in more detail. With respect to the initial acquisition, it is our preliminary view that there may be aspects of that can be financed on a tax-exempt basis. The bulk of it is likely to be issued on a taxable basis, but on an ongoing basis, the authority for capital, its capital needs should be able to access the capital markets on a very advantageous basis and on a tax-exempt basis. I would be happy to. I know there's a number of people left to speak this afternoon, and be happy to address any questions that the committee may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we'll go to your comrade here first, Mr. Fisher.
Thanks very much. Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, thank you. Senator Deckard invited me to speak at this hearing, and I'm pleased to do so. My name is Tony Fisher. I'm a managing director in the Municipal Securities Group of UBS. Our office is in downtown Portland. I'm a resident of Lake Oswego, Clackamas County. My firm, UBS, is a leading investment banker and merger and acquisition advisor to the global power industry, and as well as a leading investment banker to state and local governments, including the public power industry. I'd like to talk today about our perspectives on the possible acquisition of PGE by the state through Oregon Community Power. First, it's our view that a properly structured governance, with properly structured governance, legal powers, contractual management arrangements, a governmental entity such as OCP could successfully access the capital markets to complete a long-term acquisition financing of PGE on terms that create value, both for PGE's customers and for the Enron creditors, compared with their alternative of a distribution of PGE stock. We base this view upon a number of factors, including recent precedent. The most significant recent precedent is that of the Long Island Power Authority in New York, or LIPA, which was created by the state of New York. And in 1998, LIPA borrowed over $5 billion in the municipal debt markets to acquire all of the common stock of LILCO, the Long Island Lighting Company, which served over a million customers on Long Island. When LIPA sold its LILCO acquisition debt, it had investment-grade ratings from all three major rating agencies, and it obtained over $2 billion worth of AAA-rated bond insurance commitments to minimize the overall cost of capital. We have spoken with a number of the largest providers of municipal bond insurance, as well as other industry experts, and anticipate that a properly structured power authority and bond transaction, should it be able to obtain a significant amount of AAA-rated bond insurance capacity, which will both minimize the costs to our ratepayers and ensure the overall success of the initial transaction. We would note that today, LIPA's ratings have now been upgraded into the A category by all three rating agencies. It's also our view that Oregon Community Power has an extraordinary one-time-only opportunity, if you will, as others have said, to create lasting value for PGE's customers and the region's economy. The basis of this value creation has been already discussed in terms of being able to avoid payment of federal income tax. Over the last 3 years, that's been over $175 million charge that the ratepayers have paid through rates. And as has been mentioned, we would enjoy a much lower cost of capital than PGE. As we all know, electric utilities are highly capital-intensive enterprises. Their credit ratings and capital structure in large measure drives their cost of service. PGE's authorized cost of capital set by the PUC is 9%.
And in the current market, we would anticipate, as Mr. Goh mentioned, that even with taxable debt financing, OCP's acquisition debt would cost around 6% or even less for 30-year fixed-rate self-liquidating financing. And over time, its debt cost should decline even further as it becomes eligible for tax exemption on its municipal bonds to finance new capital assets, which is not insignificant given that the company in its 10K has indicated over the next 3 years it will need to expend between $800 and $900 million on new capital assets. So this financing advantage will continue over time to create additional value for the customers in the region. As was mentioned earlier by Senator Deckert, today long-term taxes and financing would cost about 5% on a project such as Port Westward, again compared with the blended overall equity and debt cost of capital of the current regulated utility of 9% or so. Lastly, we also would note that OCP has the potential to create further incremental benefits for its customers in the coming years. While it's not that easy, as easy to quantify, the public power communities that we are familiar with embrace the benefits of true local control by local governing boards who are accountable to their citizens and their customers. The more tangible financial benefits are evident in the enviable AA and high A category ratings held by many public power systems, such as those serving Eugene, Seattle, Tacoma, Phoenix, San Antonio, Austin, Los Angeles, Orlando, Jacksonville, and many others. So clearly, we see no reason why OCP cannot become a comparable regional asset over time. It's starting with an already strong operating utility, PGE, a great service area, a low-cost diversified generation portfolio, and adding to that the structural cost advantages that we have addressed and the responsiveness of local control. Be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. The chair just wants to point out, I'm in a quandary here because we have a lot of people and we can either ask questions or have other people speak. What we're going to be doing, this is going to be moving progressively on a faster track now that we've got this together. We're kind of getting a 30,000. We had a 40,000 foot overview. Now we're kind of down to 25 to 30,000 feet. And I've asked Ms. Van Winkle when we meet again, which will be next week, we're going to set that up for an extended afternoon long to get into the questions as all of us have a chance to look over what we have before us today to formulate our questions and go into more detail of that. Just to let you know, it's difficult in these small ones, but I want to have a chance to have the opportunity to do that. Thank you. The financial perspective was very valuable. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just on these two, and I don't know if Doug and Anthony can be back next week, but if we had any questions, I'm not sure if we have these two gentlemen back with us next week, so I would just...
Okay, well, then we'll take a moment. I would have one then, and that is your overview, Mr. Goh, particularly said, other than some, what you felt were some basically your technical changes in the language, you felt the structure from a financing standpoint, and Mr. Fisher, you seemed to enunciate, you know, a similar theme, was viable and with some minor changes would be in a position to be utilized.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, yes, the answer is yes. I think that the basic structure is there. This is a structure, as Mr. Fisher has indicated, many of our clients across the country have issued billions of dollars of highly rated debt to do similar things. So we think that the basic structure is there, and it's a policy choice of whether the state wants to proceed or not.
Okay. And I brought that up, members, only because, again, as we talk about the other public power options, you know, one of the comments, you know, certainly has been from the city that they're the only ones that are in a position to be able to purchase this in any type of expeditious fashion. And I just wanted to, you know, get on the record what our financial experts felt in terms of if this product were to be enacted, that it could be utilized. So, other questions on the finances? Thank you, gentlemen, very much for taking the time to come.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to have Tom Bryan, Tony Hyde, and Shantu Shang, or Shah Shah, it looks like, come forward, please. We'll start with Mr. Bryan. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. One of the advantages of going in this position is that all the experts and key parties have spoken, so I can be, I'll try to be as brief as possible in understanding the committee's time. I just appreciate very much the opportunity to comment today. I have represented Washington County in discussions about...
Oh, yeah, tell us who you are.
I should probably do that today. My name is Tom Bryan. I'm chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners.
Thank you.
First time down here. I didn't.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a while. I have to get retrained. I do appreciate your time today. I wanted to comment briefly on just a very few things. I represented Washington County in discussions about our power supply, its costs, and what should we do post Sierra Pacific and post Enron over the last 3 years. Because of our concern, the counties that constitute the service territory, the six counties that include all of the service territory, met and looked over all of our options, including the one of forming our very own district and buying PGE, if necessary. Frankly, our bias has always been that we prefer a local Oregon company own and operate the power company, PGE. When Northwest Natural Gas stepped forward, we were happy to stand down and wish them well. After that effort did not succeed, the counties again initiated an effort, including working with the City of Portland, to explore a number of possibilities, including a state-created power authority. Disadvantage at the time was we were out of session, so there was no place to go to discuss that. And then when TPG first came into the scene, we again stood down, hoping that that would work out well. But as we learned in observing and talking with those folks and others, their flaws started to show, and for good reason, I believe, the PUC rejected that proposal. So here we are again, but hopefully wiser, and with the session, with the legislature in session, a beautiful opportunity for Oregon. You might wonder why Washington County has spent so much time and, frankly, money working on this issue. We don't want to own anything. We don't want to operate this. We don't necessarily even want to be on any boards or committees. I do support local government's request to be on the nominating committee, however, not me personally, but that there be representation. Our whole question has always been, what is best for Oregon? What's best for our residents and for our businesses? We've learned from negotiating with Intel, for example, on a fairly large strategic investment program that taxes alone, getting the tax structure right alone is not enough. That may open the door or pave the way, but we've heard a lot also about stable, reliable power costs and clean, reasonably priced water, and of course K-12 education. So this is part of the package. We are working on a water supply matter. We're working on power because we believe these are building blocks for the kind of economy and community and state that we want. I'm really grateful to Senator Deckert and Senator Nelson and Representative Berger for their time and energy and the effort that they're putting in on this matter. It's worth noting that it's been great and refreshing to see AOI, ICNU, CUB, and others around the table working and exploring Oregon community power and more recently really working to develop what I believe is our best option. It's not only our best option available, it's a good option for Oregon. It's free of the operational motives inherent in a private business, that is profit. It has operational opportunities such as that you've heard about, no federal tax, no profit incentives, preferred cost of capital. These things matter, and I think while I think we have to be careful about guaranteeing percentages of reductions and all of that, the thing I think we can guarantee is that we can provide the lowest available. Whatever the externalities deliver us, we can deliver the lowest available. I think we're getting close to an innovative and historical action in Senate Bill 1008, an opportunity to benefit the entire state long-term by stabilizing rates and achieving the lowest available rates for all consumers. We encourage this committee to keep the bill moving and to provide this option for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I know Chair Bryan might have to leave.
Yes.
And he was supposed to be on earlier. And can I just ask one question?
Yes.
One point that you made, and Tom, we haven't discussed this much, but we've seen this as somewhat of a two-step process. One is the legislature has to grant some authority, but there really then is, and you experience this when the legislature is not in session, then it's another threshold question is actually, do you marshal the forces at that point, and does it still pencil out and the due diligence occurs, and
exactly.
Do you actually go forward and make the call to the trustee?
Right.
And I don't know if you want to comment at all on that. I do know that you're behind schedule.
Right.
And
That's fine. I very much appreciate having the opportunity to speak. Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckert, yeah, obviously, I view this as an option or tool in our toolbox. It's a critical one. I think it's, as I said, the best one at this time. But there are the others. And the critical thing to me is that I think we get this done right, carefully written as it's being written, and get it approved so it's available. There might be triggers that you want to put in there when the governor would enact this or something, but clearly due diligence is required. The companies that have taken runs at purchase have spent in the neighborhood of $10 or $11 million in due diligence. There's a lot of information on the record that we don't have to duplicate, so I think the state's costs would be far less, but nonetheless there's some serious money there, at least in the few millions, I would guess. But you have to remember, you know, what you're buying and what it means to Oregon. And given the right statutes, and I think all of the expertise that's available to us, we can do it right. It's an innovative application of the public corporation as compared to the other public corporations we have. Those are public corporations which directly operate, and this would be one that would select an operator, and I think there's a pretty obvious choice who that would be. And it's a great blend of the private sector expertise with the public interest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tony Hyde, Chairman of the Board of Commissioners in Columbia County. And Columbia County is the site that's been mentioned all afternoon, the newest Port Westward power production plant that currently exists, and now a new $200 million plant that's being constructed as we speak. And that's the specifics that I wanted to speak to. Now that you're at the 25,000-foot level, I think it's important that we pay close attention to the provision in the amendments under Section 17 that talks about payment in lieu of taxes. In order to provide the infrastructure for the $200 million plant that's currently being constructed, Columbia County developed an urban renewal district, of which I'm also the chair of, and we will, as a result of the infrastructure that we're going to provide, encumber ourselves to some $21.8 million, which is going to pencil out to about $35 million in debt over a 25-year period. And it's very important to us that you pay close attention to the methodology that's in place, or that is put in place for the payment in lieu of taxes. Tilt in general is a not a very tasty term for counties. We've been dealing with the PILT issue on a federal level with every turn of the legislative bodies in Washington, D.C., so we have to re-educate, and it becomes at least an impression of an entitlement over time. And that's why I concern myself with the term PILT. Perhaps we could do something besides payment in lieu of taxes in terms of terminology, so that we don't have to find ourselves in 10 years, because we're talking 25 years just for Columbia County alone in terms of encumberment, and potential for up to $6 million a year in revenue loss if we have to fight this battle with every administrative change. So that's very important. Secondly, with almost $2 billion worth of value, assessed value statewide, I do think that it would be important that the cities and the counties have a seat on the nominating committee, because they have a big stake in this. And third, when you discussed the difference between the Portland plan and this plan, I would ask you to think for a moment, and I would just say publicly that I'm not in support of the Portland plan. But I would like to ask you to think for a moment how the Portland plan would conceptually exacerbate the urban-rural divide. And this doesn't.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Deckert, Chair Metzger, Senator Walker, and Senator Anderson. Thank you for allowing me my comments today. My name is Shantu Shah. I'm a resident of Senator Deckert's area in Rolla Hills. And I'm also an electrical engineer and with past experience in operating a large electricity board in India, as large as the state, as well as also I have experience in the generation, power distribution, and other things. The reason I am speaking here is in opposition to this bill today, as well as in opposition to the city of Portland is providing. Both are bureaucratic bills or bureaucratic entities, and I'll read my statement to prove this. This is a bureaucratic thing. We already have in the state the electric cooperatives as well as the PUDs, and this bill does not provide anything beyond that. In fact, this is worse than those things, and I'll read my statement here, which I have already provided in writing. Argument in opposition to Oregon State Bill 1008. This is the first opposition today. State Bill 1008 is a backdoor sale of PG assets to the Oregon Community Power at a price tag that's most favorable to Enron and PGE creditors by the legislators who did not say a word in favor of public utility district measures put on the various ballots in PGE territory districts in Oregon during and prior to November 2004 general elections. In a sense, the sponsors of this bill, as well as Oregon governor, who will have veto power to nominate the members of OCP, are in the back pockets of PGE and Enron, which may have contributed large sums to their campaign funds. This you might take with a grain of salt. I don't know that. It requires that board members have a management experience of large utilities, public utilities. That way, Enron and PGE executives would be appointed by the governor as board of OCP. PGE will simply have a new name as OCT, with a previous management of PGE and Enron or Texas Pacific Group's proposed board members of Oregon Electric Company that was recently denied PGE sale by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Oregon Justice Department should investigate if there is a conflict of interest involved in the sponsorship of this bill, as it is limited to only PGE and excludes other utilities. House Bill 1008 is a band-aid for Enron and PGE by trumping other entities like the City of Portland, Oregon Mutual Utility, or Oregon Electricity Board Co-op, which I have formed recently under ORS 192.410-192490 and registered in Oregon on February 10, 2003. Registration number 268879-92 to acquire the PGE assets. No doubt, I don't have the wherewithal for that, but it can be done by the certain national authorities which provide the financing for the co-ops. For all the ratepayers within PGE territory, OCP will not provide any input or say by the ratepayers in its management as compared to the PUD and electric co-ops, which are managed and run by the not-for-profit boards elected by the ratepayers themselves. So this is not a consumer entity, but this is a government entity, what I call House Bill, Senate Bill 1008. This bill carries a huge cost to Oregon taxpayers, since if it becomes a law, it will vastly expand the state government employment role by making PGE employees, when acquired, state employees that will add to the Oregon payrolls and various government employee benefits. It will expand the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund. Earlier said it will not, but it will be discriminatory not to provide retirement funds to this kind of employees at the humongous cost to the all taxpayers, creating a further deficit in the state budget and much larger cutbacks in school budgets. it will be detrimental to education in Oregon. House Bill 1008 will simply add to the government bureaucracy. House Bill 1008 is not in the public interest, and the taxpayers and the Oregonians who reside outside the PGE territory and would not obtain any, and they would not obtain any economic benefit from this bill. I urge Senator, state senators, to defeat House Bill 1008 as it is not in the public interest. Alternatively, this bill must be put on the ballots during the general elections for all taxpayers to decide yes or no, as it impacts all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, all of you. Where we are right now, because I'm in fairness to Senate Bill 671, I have four other people signed up for their overview on Senate Bill 1008. All are regular advocates in the legislature, Mr. Strobeck, Mr. Meek, Ms. Trojan, and Ms. Henry. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1008 and Ms. Flicker. And those five individuals will be the first people that will be up to testify next week when we have the more extensive. Now you'll have more time to really look at the amendments and give us your, and we'll see that you are the first ones that will be called. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 671 and ask John Stagberg and Bruce Landry to come forward, please. Senate Bill 671, members, is the financing tool that could create a mutual that someone could utilize to approach the PUC as a mutual company. And gee, he changed his look. He looks like Dave Barrows. But in fairness, I wanted to make sure you had an opportunity to give us your update as well today, and colleagues and members in the audience. And you have those amendments before you as well. This will give us a real good opportunity for all of us to review these and have thoughtful questions. And again, I've asked Ms. Van Winkle to set up a four-hour hearing next week in which we'll get into the nuts and bolts of this. So welcome. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Dave Barrows, representing the Oregon Mutual Utility Group. Bruce, unfortunately, had to leave to take his daughter to a doctor's appointment.
Yeah,
so it's not in any way it's not a commentary, Mr. Chairman. He just had to leave. He's much better looking than I am. And so we have with us today Mr. John Stagberg, who's the chief financial person in this organization, and he's the one you really want to listen to. So I'm just here to, it's eye candy.
Okay, welcome. And we have a dash 4 and dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 671. So, welcome.
Good afternoon, Senators. I appreciate this opportunity to speak before your committee here. We're representing Oregon Mutual Utility Development Incorporated.
Yeah, your name, sir.
I'm sorry, John Stagberg. We're representing Oregon Mutual Utility Development Incorporated. OMU is, to make it shorter, I'm a little nervous too, was formed by 16 individuals, all PGE ratepayers. Most of us have significant electric utility industry expertise, who were concerned about the future of Portland General, particularly as the Oregon Electric TPG transaction was progressing. The biggest concern we had was in regards to what the future for ratepayers would be in a private ownership structure such as the TPG proposal. We're here just to facilitate the acquisition of Portland General by its customers. Oregon Mutual Utility is not intending to have any management role in PGE. We believe, as we've heard earlier, that PGE is a very well-run company that on its own can manage itself in the future very effectively for customers. We believe that the customers, by owning PGE and perfectly aligning interests of shareholders and customers, which in our proposal, just like the states, would be one and the same, would provide many benefits. The way we, as proposed in 671, and this is essentially a mechanism that will provide for the acquisition of PGE. The financing vehicle is a very common type of financing structure that has been used in the utility industry since the mid-90s. Over $30 billion of stranded asset securitization bonds have been issued to reduce costs for utilities as they transform through a deregulating environment in specific states such as California, Texas, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. We essentially borrowed this structure of stranded asset securitization to implement the lowest cost financing that you can find in the corporate markets for a utility. The structure we have are proposing would require the commission, well, through the legislation and specific statutes, that the commission would approve of the acquisition costs, which would be the common stock of Portland General Electric from Enron. They would approve a fixed acquisition charge that each of the customers would pay based upon usage, and these are retail customers. This fixed acquisition charge would then be securitized through a common financing technique called securitization, and it obtained AAA rating to achieve the lowest cost source of customers to purchase the utility. This should have no impact on Portland General's credit ratings. Portland General will be Portland General as it was and as it will be in the future. All profits that are generated through Portland General would be returned to customers. In our structure, because the customers are the owners, we believe that it will not be subject to federal income taxation. This is really under a mechanism under that we are borrowing from cooperative tax law. We will be either falling under subchapter T or section 501c12 of the tax code. All other taxes will be paid, including we would be exempt from state income tax, but we are proposing to pay as a payment in lieu of taxation an equivalent of state income taxes through the customer payments. This will provide for local control, stable, dependable rates. All profits will be retained in Oregon, long-term ownership, transparency, and ethical management practices. We believe we have the ability to get this transaction done. We have we have engaged an investment banking firm with extreme utility expertise by the name of New Harbor. We have local counsel Perkins Coie out of Portland. We have Washington, D.C. counsel of Thompson Hine engaged. We're currently talking with three of the top four big four accounting firms. One of them, the one we're not talking to, is PGE's auditors, inherent conflict there. New Harbor has provided us with a highly confident letter that the financing will be available at the time we need it, subject to legislation and OPCUC approval. If there's any other information I can try to fill in, I'd be pleased to address those.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that obviously we haven't had a chance to look at the two sets of new amendments, but we will be prepared to come back at the next hearing with specific response to those two sets of amendments, either in writing or person or both.
Okay, thank you.
So we appreciate it.
I do have a question. We talked with the earlier group as well. What this would be allow a tool to the PUC, where you could approach the PUC with, or the PUC could and would, if they agreed it was in the best interest of whoever wanted to purchase the utility, to use as a financing mechanism. I mean, it's a significant difference between the other proposal, which is a organization put together to purchase the utility. This is a financing mechanism. So my question for that could be you, it could be Senator Walker, Energy Inc., could approach the Public Utility Commission with a proposal. And because of the due diligence, of course, the PUC would do as well, my question to you would be, where so many people seem to have a sense of urgency about this issue, where do you see this proposal as being effective for, say, the acquisition of PGE because of the, I guess you might just say, you know, the race to the finish line that someone else is, so many other people are trying to achieve?
I'm not really sure I totally understood your question.
Well, just how, I mean, that you could actually effect this into a proposal that could be accepted by the PUC and put, and then enacted for a purchase in a time frame that everyone else says is very short.
Okay. No, I think that's right. I think it is a fairly short time frame. I believe Stephen Cooper was pretty clear that if there's not a deal done by April of next year, there's going to be a distribution. And I think all the parties agree that that is not the right thing for Oregon ratepayers or residents. We believe that we can get this done. We have to get, first of all, this bill approved by the legislature through the Senate and the House in order to have the statutory criteria in order to issue the bonds, which provides the bondholders with sufficient comfort that they are going to get their principal interest paid. Then the next step is we have to go through and get approval from the OPUC that we are providing the benefit for customers for, in order for them to approve the acquisition and the issuance of the securities. We would anticipate that that would occur all in tandem, so that upon a PUC approval, the financing will be available and we can immediately launch an offer. The process of getting PUC approval can be lengthy, as we saw with TPG. Our intent is that in advance of applying with the PUC, we will be working with all the customer groups to try to stipulate all of the issues that are particular to their interests, so we can go into the PUC with an application that is not going to take an extraordinarily long time to have negotiated and reduce the level of intervention that we would be able to accelerate the process quicker.
Thank you. Questions? One thing I would ask of you, and I'll be saying the same thing to the proponents of Senate Bill 1008, is that I would like for you to put together an analysis of the proposal as currently written, and how you see that being effected upon passage by the legislature. So we have an opportunity prior to the next hearing, which we are going to endeavor to have a week from today. And again, I'm trying to look for an all afternoon so we can really get into this. But and so that could be provided to members and available to anyone else in the public early in the week, so that people would have a chance to come in with educated questions about that. And that analysis would be really helpful as we pursue that. Yes, Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all the work that you've put into this and the time that you've spent, the countless hours that I know that you've spent on this proposal. Just a couple of quick questions that come to mind. First, I guess questions that have swam around this have been, and it's certainly one that Oregon Community Power must answer, and it does it with a kind of a public process, is, why would ratepayers hand over a blank check to negotiate with the trustee to this entity? Because ultimately, as those negotiations go on, it's their money that is being negotiated in the purchase price.
As far as this entity, you mean Oregon Mutual Utility?
Correct. Or any entity.
Any entity. Well, you know, actually, as was pointed out earlier, this legislation, anybody could use it to acquire Portland General. In fact, Portland General could do it themselves if they so chose. I think that, you know, we've had a late start getting out of the gate, not because we haven't been working on this. We've been working on this since the summer last year. But we were precluded from vetting our structure or introducing our structure until Texas Pacific formally walked away. Our counsel advised us that if we did come out in advance, and we could be accused of tortious interference. Mm-hmm. So we have a late start getting out of the gate, and we've got limited, we have 16 people, and a lot of them have day jobs, and so we're trying as best as we can to cover the customer groups we can, and it's not as fast as we'd like, but it's going to take some time, and we hope we generate their trust that I'm a PGE ratepayer, I'm a longtime Oregonian, all of the rest of us are the same. You know, we're not looking for jobs at PGE, We're not looking for a huge payday. We think it's the best thing for Oregon customers, and we believe that having the state approach and the city approach and our approach all have to be viewed the same as the right structure to take PGE local and keep rates down, stable, and keep money in Oregon. It's kind of a trust me if we'd like to earn.
Well, Mr. Chair, just on the trust me, I mean, I think it's important for this committee, and as we have review whether the dash 4 or dash 5 here, trust absolutely, but verify, because the stakes are so large here in terms of, we heard about the 53% rate increase and what it did to jobs and Oregonians' livability, and so to me, trust is critical, but verifying, and I guess the second question is just on the tax status. I've heard varying reports, and I don't know if you've been able to obtain a letter from the IRS in terms of the federal tax exemption, but that obviously has big implications in terms of rates, and mm-hmm. I would be interested in seeing that at the earliest opportunity.
Yeah, we'd be happy to share that with you. Again, due to until TPG formally walked away, all the accounting firms are conflicted. We couldn't even talk to them, so we expect to appoint an accounting firm tomorrow. And we have talked with them in depth about this subject. They're working on the research. They don't see obstacles. We may need to get a private letter ruling from the IRS, but they don't see that being a lengthy process that would harm our ability to get the deal done in advance of a stock distribution. But we'd be pleased to share that with you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'll just say that for whoever's still in the room or whatever, we will endeavor, I can't speak for the group because it's to do the analysis that you requested, Mr. Chair. We will try Tuesday, maybe, to get it, to mm-hmm. have it done. We would obviously get members to, copies to the members of the committee, the staff, Senator Walker, and other interested yeah. members. And for anybody in the audience, I'll have copies, and all they got to do is find me down at the Lobby Message Center, where I seem to live most of my life, and I'll have copies available for anybody that asks.
That would be great. And we give it to Ms. Van Winkle, some members of the public.
Okay,
can get them
from Teresa, we can get them from
That'd
Dave or whoever.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Thank you for getting us on today.
You betcha. We do have 4 minutes, so Mr. Meek, you are the next one signed up for this one, so please. Saw Mr. Meek earlier this morning in revenue. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd rather talk about the other bill, but on its surface, this thing just appears to be counterproductive. You heard a lot about Oregon Mutual Utility, but this bill doesn't have anything.
Please say your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Dan Meek. I represent various ratepayer groups, including the Utility Reform Project. You heard about some of the details about the proposed Oregon Mutual Utility, but this bill doesn't have anything to do with Oregon Municipal Utility. It would make the securitization process available to any private entity buying PGE. It would authorize the PUC to put into all PGE bills an irrevocable and unbypassable surcharge, and to basically make the state back it up to pay the what's called intangible acquisition cost of buying PGE. Now, unless the buyer needs to increase rates above what they would otherwise be, this bill is not necessary. If you could step into PGE rates and pay off your acquisition costs, no problem. So the point of this bill appears to be to authorize a rate increase to enable the buyer to finance, much more securely finance the purchase. The result of this would be to bid up the price for PGE, as it would grant viability to additional private equity, private entity purchasers, and in turn that would force Oregon Community Power or the City of Portland to pay more, because they would be in a bidding war with this entity that essentially the legislature is helping to finance by passing a bill like this. You might ask yourself, why would the state want to enable a private purchaser to pay more for the same assets that the state is attempting in one, or the city is attempting in one way or another to purchase? It's kind of like, you know, going to an auction and then providing low-cost money to the people who are bidding against you. And the only entity that it seems to me that ultimately benefits from this is the Enron creditors. They'll get more money out of Oregon for PGE if private purchasers are able to use this mechanism to secure securitize their additional amounts, basically have a guaranteed rate increase if they pay more for PGE.
Well, Mr. Meek, while you're here, and you did that very concisely, so regarding Senate Bill 1008, the note on the sheet said you were thinking when it said for or against. So why don't you give us just a brief thoughts, and we will have you back up, as I said, when we get into more detail. But if you want to give some initial observations, we can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't bring my notes on that with me.
Well, you'll have more time on next Thursday, but I'd just be curious of your initial observations.
Well, it's quite a difference 3 years makes. The Oregon Public Power Coalition started communicating and contacting state legislators in early 2002 about activating the state power authority under Section 11D of the Oregon Constitution. And Senate Bill 1008 is somewhat similar to that, although it seems to establish a weaker entity because it expressly excludes the authority of the entity to exercise eminent domain, and so therefore ties about nine fingers behind its back in negotiating with Enron. We also, of course, for 3 years have urged the city of Portland to acquire PGE. The city is now apparently acting, and actually seems to be in a better position to act than Oregon Community Power.
Now, please comment on that. Why do you say that?
Well, it's already been working on this for over 2 years, and it's already spent something on the order of $1 million doing its due diligence and arranging for financing. So I think the city is way ahead of any state entity that could be created. But in just a second, I think there's a way to mesh these two approaches together. On the specifics, the bill does not provide a schedule for Oregon Community Power to be up and running. According to Enron, the stock distribution could begin within a year. They've been saying now April 2006. And after that starts to occur, acquiring PGE becomes much more complicated for anyone, for any public entity. Number two is that Oregon Community Power expressly has no power to condemn, as I mentioned before. The city of Portland does have power to condemn a large share of the assets of PGE, if not all, and there's some question about that. Third, under this bill, Oregon Community Power expressly rejects the opportunity for federal preference power. The city hasn't rejected that. 80% of federal preference power goes to the state of Washington. So if we have a new entity in Oregon that qualifies for it, it's mainly going to be coming out of the state of Washington and not out of the state of Oregon anyway. And I don't see any reason that the citizens of Washington are less entitled to federal power than the citizens of Oregon are any less entitled than the citizens of Washington. Fourth, this bill only allows acquisition of PGE assets, if you look in Section 20, but Enron says it will only sell PGE stock and not assets, so there's some disconnect there. Then, fifth item, Sections 31 through 33, in the new amendments that we got just during the hearing today, establish a system of deregulation, direct access for all non-residential customers, it forces the new entity to allow its distribution system to be used by any supplier. It allows them to impose a stranded cost surcharge on ratepayers. It's an entirely new deregulation system that doesn't apply to any existing publicly owned utility in Oregon. So I think there needs to be discussion of that. Sixth, if this entity does get up and running quickly, it could well itself push the price up that Enron creditors can demand. Once again, you'd have the city bidding on PGE, and you'd have this entity bidding on PGE if they're both up and active. And that doesn't seem to be a particularly productive thing to do. Each of them could come back with better offers and better offers until the ultimate beneficiaries of having the competing entities would be the Enron creditors. So one possible solution to think of, since it's going to take some time for this entity to become up and running in any event, is for this entity not to commence negotiations with Enron until the city concludes that it cannot succeed. In that case, the city will have its shot. If it cannot succeed, then you'll have the state authority to be able to step in and acquire PGE for the public. I think one thing that the legislature should be looking at right now is to clarify and perhaps enhance the eminent domain authority of the city of Portland, to make it clear that the city would have authority to acquire by eminent domain all of the assets of PGE located in Oregon, whether they're distribution, generation, or inside or outside the city of Portland or the service area. That would strengthen the hand of Portland in negotiating with the Enron creditors, and that can only benefit us. So those are just initial thoughts on that, but I would say that it appears that the amendments that were handed out today are, as far as structure goes, are significantly better than the version of the bill that was handed out last week. So it seems to be improving.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
And thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Okay, before we conclude, and again, I would ask Senator Deckert also to look at giving us a written summation of the sections that would be available to the members of the public as well as the members of the committee as soon as possible, so that when we convene for this topic again in more extensive, we can get into more of the nuts and bolts of what we have, as recognizing you're still solving some of the issues, a few of which were aired today. I think a few questions that that need to be answered, and you know, these are things I'm going to be looking for as part of this package of bills to consider. Number one is the due diligence. I don't know exactly what it is. I've heard that TPG spent upwards of $10 million on due diligence. Any proposal has a requirement for due diligence, not just because someone else has some paper on that, and I'm I'm concerned about that. And what is the answer for doing due diligence before going forward with any proposal that would put a change of ownership into a place? The asset versus liability question. There are significant liabilities with Portland General Electric. Some have been mentioned here mapped out in terms of some of the language about purchasing assets. You know, what about the liabilities? How is that equation being handled in any proposal? I think there's another question that has to be answered, and a few have addressed it in different ways, and I think everybody should be prepared to do this, and that is, does PGE really need to be saved? You know, when we had this discussion 2 years ago, there was a real fervor because of Sierra Pacific, because there was a concern that control of the entity would be going outside, and this evolved greater, certainly with TPG. Part of the key arguments at the time was the fact that we had a local company, it's been here 100 years, we need to preserve that, we can't let it disappear. And yet one can make the case that that's exactly where PG is now returning, to a local company headquartered in Portland, Oregon, albeit a private company, which is owned by no more than 5% of anyone, as I understand it from talking to the attorneys with the Department of Justice and others. It's basically what PG used to be. So what we really have evolved to, and it's a very important discussion, is really not saving PGE, in my view, from the bad guys. The bad guys are gone, and the PUC has set such a high bar. I think it's going to be very difficult for someone to, you know, put the angst into ownership of PGE. But we do have a very important question, which 1008 addresses and others, and that is, we've really evolved this now to a public versus private ownership discussion. And I think we need to really continue to focus on that. I think we also need to focus on the advantages. We have talked basically prima facie. I know the city has talked about $100 million in savings. They don't pay taxes. I understand from the PUC and Senator Decker and I were on a conference call that the rates for ratepayers are really set on an equity of $1.8 billion. And if you pay $2.8 billion, you know, for that, where's that other $1 billion going to be recovered from? Yeah, and does that offset the savings that you might have in terms of, you know, interest and lack of taxes? So those are questions that, you know, please be prepared to answer on that. I think those are really, really critical as we look at what's the best future, not only for the company serving the ratepayers, but the ratepayers and the state as a whole. So that's just an overview of questions we'll be asking. Again, we're going to look for a long hearing next week. Thank you all for being here. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 671, and we'll adjourn the committee.